listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. What causes a child to grow up gay or straight or bisexual? Neuroscientist Simon LeVay notes that one-third of all Americans believe that being homosexual is a lifestyle choice. This is about the same as the fraction of Americans who think gay people are, quote, born that way. He also points out that for some reason, no poll has asked straight Americans what made them heterosexual. How many asked would say they chose to be straight? In his fascinating book, Gay, Straight, and the Reason Why, The Science of Sexual Orientation, LeVay first reviews the principal non-biological theories that have been presented over the years about what determines sexual orientation and discusses the significant shortcomings of those theories. And as he notes, almost everyone has an opinion about that. Then he brilliantly summarizes where the quest for a biological explanation of sexual orientation stands today. And he's going to take us on a tour of laboratories that specialize in genetics, endocrinology, neuroscience, cognitive psychology, evolutionary psychology, and more. He may not get to all of that tonight, which will really make you want to read the book. It's really a fascinating book. I'll just briefly give you some biographical background on our speakers tonight. Simon LeVay is a British-born neuroscientist. He served on the faculties of Harvard Medical School and the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. He's best known for his research on the brain and sexuality and spent many years studying the visual system. He's written 10 previous books, including the New York Times bestseller, When Science Goes Wrong, and Queer Science, published in 1996, A Survey of Sexual Orientation Research. He's written also books on earthquakes, volcanoes, Parkinson's disease, and extraterrestrial life. So Simon's curiosity extends to many topics. In conversation with Simon tonight, we're very honored to have Dr. Larry Swanson. This is his fourth Aloud program. I'm teasing him that he's going to give up neuroscience to be a talk show host. He is the Appleman Professor of Biological Sciences and a member of the Neuroscience Research Institute at USC, where he directs a lab investigating brain systems that investigate motivation and emotion. Before moving to USC, he spent 10 years at the Salk Institute in La Jolla, where one of his colleagues was Simon LeVay. Larry's recent book, Brain Architecture, Understanding the Basic Plan, presents a new theory of the nervous system organization, and his atlas, Brain Maps, is in his third edition. Those are just a few of his accomplishments, and he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. It gives me great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Simon LeVay and Larry Swanson to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to see you. It's been probably 15 years or so.
Good to see you too, Larry.
But I have to tell you, I just thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. And the thing I think I liked about it the most was that, you know, this can be an extremely emotional, contentious issue, obviously. And you've taken a really nice bird's eye view of this that is in many ways, very objective and looking at what the evidence actually is one way or another. And I think that, to me, that's probably one of the great features of the book.
Thanks very much.
So I think in terms, you know, I was thinking about this conversation tonight, and Simon has taken this biological sort of evidence-based approach to this whole question of gay and straight. And having done that, I think it's important to learn a little bit more about Simon's background and what his qualifications actually are for spouting off about all of this. And I know, you know, you, I don't know where to start, but I know Harvard, maybe?
Well, one qualification I have is that I'm gay. so that's part of the motivation, I suppose. I mean, a lot of scientists actually study topics that in some way impinge on their own personal lives, and I make no apology for the fact that I chose a topic that was personally relevant to me. But obviously, there's a sort of professional background to it, too, and I guess that's what you were going to talk about.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. As Louise mentioned, our labs were next to each other at the Salk Institute back in the 80s. And I have to say, we were studying different things. I didn't know you that well, but at that point, I didn't know you were gay. And actually, I didn't even think about it until this incredible paper came out in 1991 of work that you were doing right next door that... sort of changed the whole course, I think, of research in this field.
Well, I should mention first of all that Larry Swanson is the leading expert in the world on the hypothalamus, the area that I studied in one brief flirtation, if you like, and several other regions of the brain related to the hypothalamus and the functions of these parts of the brain that are so important to our lives. So it's with a certain amount of humility that I sit here and talk about this topic in front of someone who knows a lot more about it than actually I ever will.
Well, but, the genesis of all this is really interesting because, as Louise mentioned, Simon, has this very solid... Well, he went to Cambridge where he got his degree in natural sciences, got a PhD in neuroanatomy, and then went to Harvard, where you studied the visual system in a lot of detail. And, looking at mechanisms, related to what happens to the brain, actually, when you have, a lazy eye, strabismus, there's something wrong with one of your eyes, what effect does that have on your vision? So, you really got into sort of the whole structure of the nervous system and how it works as a really hot... young neuroscientist.
How hot, I don't know, but there is actually a connection in a way between the research I did earlier on the visual cortex and the hypothalamic work, because in the cortex I was really asking a similar question about the development, how that part of the brain develops, what is the role of internal programs of biological development as compared with external things like how you see it through one eye and the other, how those affect how the brain assembles itself and later how the brain functions. So I think I was really asking, when I was studying in this study on the hypothalamus, looking at a similar question in a different part of the brain and a different part of our minds, if you like. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so we'll get into these different theories, but I think it's important, actually, just to get everybody on the same page, that the title of the book, Straight, Gay, and the Reason Why. And it's the science of sexual orientation. And, the real question to get straight in everybody's mind is actually, what is sexual orientation? How do you actually think, what does that actually mean to you, anyway?
I'll tell you, but before I do, let me show one slide. Tonight, actually, right as I speak, there's a candlelight vigil going on in West Hollywood in memory of these... five gay teenagers who all took their own lives in the months of September. And I certainly don't think that this is, the story of gay youth, if you like. I think, if anything, the story of gay youth is a very upbeat and optimistic story compared with, what maybe I experienced or people, of older people and gay people in general. But nevertheless, I think that the fact that these five young people sort of point up in a way that although Larry and I are going to be talking about science, it's a science that's very much relevant in a way to people's lives, and obviously particularly gay people and people who deal with gay people in their families or whatever. So it's not a sort of dry academic subject. It's a subject that's really kind of important, in a way perhaps too important. That is to say, you can really say, well, why should we ask questions about why people become gay or straight? What's the point of that? Why can't we just accept people for where they are and so on and not worry, if you like? Well, I don't look at it as a sort of worrying thing. I don't think that there's anything to worry about gay people or how they become gay or straight people either, for that matter. But nevertheless, these questions are really relevant to how society thinks about homosexuality, gay rights, and so on. So there is a connection, if you like, and maybe towards the end or perhaps in the questions that some of you want to ask, we could get into some of those more social aspects of what we're talking about. Now, Larry asked, well, what is sexual orientation? Sexual orientation is really the direction of someone's sexual attraction, the balance of somebody's sexual attraction to persons of the same sex and the other sex. And I stress attraction rather than sexual behavior. Now, I think this is a kind of source of a lot of confusion, if you like, and out there. Because when people talk about homosexuality being a lifestyle choice, for example, well, in a way it is. I mean, it's true, it is a lifestyle choice. You know, people are not forced into, you know, coming out as gay or engaging in gay relationships. There's plenty of gay people who've gotten heterosexually married and had children over the years. So there is, when you're talking about behavior, a tremendous amount of choice involved that has nothing to do probably with biology at all. But at the level of sexual attraction, I don't believe that anyone really sort of chooses the experience of sexual attraction they have to other people, or whether it's to males or females, or both males and females. So that's at that basic level of attraction that we're really talking about, not the level of behavior, which depends so much on circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So it's that it's really that characteristic that you have reviewed all of the studies and the literature, whether it's nature, whether it's nurture. This is the age-old question. Mm-hmm. Is it a mixture? What exactly is it? And maybe, you know, just to get things headed here in an interesting way, I mean, the first and probably oldest set of beliefs is what you said, that it's a basically a free choice. Now, you know, sort of what are the arguments or what is the evidence against that, sort of that whole line of thinking that it's just a free choice?
Well, I think, first of all, if it was simply a free choice, then gay people and straight people, for that matter, would remember making that choice. And you could ask people and they'd say, oh, yeah, I remember, you know, when I was about 14, I thought, And I mean, some people even think of it in terms of choice people make, you know, on a day-to-day basis when they're adult. You know, some people say there's really nothing more to homosexuality than straight people saying to themselves, oh, I think I'll try that gay thing this weekend. You know, that's the sort of level at which some people conceptualize the whole thing. So very few gay men or lesbians think that they made an outright choice to experience sexual attraction to one sex or the other or to both. And I think that is telling. What also speaks against the idea of choice is simply the weight of biological evidence that's now come forward that we may have opportunity to talk about in various aspects of it in the course of this conversation. But also, of course, in the book at much greater length, I talk about the evidence that basically it's not a choice, that there are at least strong biological influences that affect people's sexual orientation that you couldn't possibly conceptualize as being a matter of choice. And, you know, I wrote a book actually about 1993, a book called The Sexual Brain, and right after I published the study that on the hypothalamus that got so much media attention in 1991. And in that time, there were only about, you know, 20 or 30 studies bearing on this topic. So I was able to write a very slim volume that was, you know, about this thin. The book that that I just wrote is, as you can see, is a lot thicker in it. The bibliography has about 650 references in it. So you can see that the weight of evidence is much larger now than it was 20 years ago. And I think anyone who would finish reading this book would hopefully be persuaded that the choice really has little or anything to do with a person's sexual orientation.
I think that's certainly the conclusion. So then to get into the biological part of it, we should really spend some time on. But, you know, every year I teach freshman biology at USC, and, you know, it's sort of how the body works and all. And I always end up with a couple lectures on reproduction and sexuality. And it's from a broad biological perspective, this is so interesting. You have species of lizards which are 100% female, for example. There are no male lizards, whiptail lizards. There are species of fish that are all born female. And the oldest, biggest one turns into a male. And if you take that big one out, the next biggest female turns into a male. This is called serial hermaphroditism. There are, of course, then classic hermaphrodites like tapeworms. When a tapeworm gets inside of you, there's no way it can mate. So it actually has both sets of organs. So, you know, when you get into actually the biology of sexuality in a really big, broad view, nothing actually surprises you. And one of your statements was that humans are animals. You know, it's an obvious statement. On the other hand, every species is different, or they wouldn't be species. So, you know, you look at sexuality in a broad way, but then you also look at it, you know, from the human perspective, but certainly from the biological point of view, that this, there's a lot of lines of evidence for the biological implications.
I mean, human biology is based on this fundamental premise that humans are animals, and it's surprising how many people really don't buy that, you know what I mean?
After Darwin, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And the idea that we can learn something useful from non-human animals about ourselves, I mean, that's fundamental, of course, to medicine and other aspects of, you know, physiology and so forth. But the idea that you can apply that idea to the mind is still foreign to a lot of people. And I think it's taken a lot of work by psychobiologists to really convince the public that animals can teach us something about humanity.
And then to get even some of the more interesting stuff just on the human level were these studies of twins,
right,
which you go into a lot of detail about. But I think that's a very instructive way to look at...
I have some... Well, I'm going to skip these ones. But here's some twins. Just I show this really just to remind you how adorable monozygotic or so-called identical twins are. This is actually comes from the Minnesota study of twins reared apart, and I guess everyone in Minnesota is blonde or something.
Yeah. So,
I understand from a Prairie Home Companion that everyone's Norwegian there or something. Is that right? So what you can see in this picture is that, you know, monozygotic twins who look like each other anatomically, of course, as we all know, also behave like each other. And you can see that, for example, if you look at the facial expressions of some of these kids, or if you look at their hand posture, what exactly these kids are doing with their hands, how they're folding their hands over each other, is uncannily similar between each member of a certain pair, but different between each pair. And this is something that seems to be genetic. You don't see that between pairs of dizygotic or fraternal twins, even though they're brought up together just like these twins are. And twins have been used in many studies to try and understand what part of a trait such as sexual orientation can be attributed to genes people inherit and what part cannot. And so generally the way that people do these studies is by recruiting pairs of twins and asking what fraction of the pairs of twins share the same sexual orientation, what fraction have different sexual orientation between the two, and how does that differ between the monozygotic twin pairs, these guys here, and the dizygotic or fraternal twin pairs who share only about half their genes, just like regular brothers or sisters. And when you go on the basis of all these twin studies that have been done, and if you go through the math, it turns out that for men, a substantial part of their sexual orientation can be attributed to genes, perhaps as much as about a half of the total reason, if you like, that a man has the sexual orientation that he has is basically a result of what genes he inherits. The actual estimates vary from study to study, so I'm saying roughly half. With women, it's probably lower. There's quite a lot of variation, again, from study to study, but it looks like perhaps only about 20% or so, or 25% of the total reason, the total heritability, the total reason that a woman has the sexual orientation that she does is a result of the genes she inherits. So genes play a role, and we know that from the twin studies, but they're not the whole story of sexual orientation, and particularly in women, they're not.
You know, while we're sort of on this line of... One of the really interesting parts of the book, and so we sort of for fair play here, is actually the differences between gay and lesbian people in terms of, you know, it's not necessarily the same biological mechanism or exactly the same underpinnings. It's a very important distinction.
That is, and we're getting some feedback here. I'm not sure what's going on, but I think it's all just been turned off now.
There we go.
Oh, Luis is coming to the rescue.
A little bit?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Now, where were we?
Gay and lesbian.
Yes. I mean, you know, Larry and I are just two, you know, aging white males, one straight, one gay, and we may not have, you know, the full perspective on the issue of sexual orientation. And it may be that people in the audience will be able to contribute more later. But what I've learned from not so much my own studies, but from reading all the literature that I have on the topic, is that sexual orientation is really not exactly parallel between men and women. There's certainly much more bisexuality in women than there is in men, that's very clear. There's more fluidity of sexual orientation in women than in men, which means that over a course of her lifetime, a woman is more likely to change the way she describes herself in the way of her sexual orientation. Generally, a move away from heterosexuality towards non-heterosexuality, but also, as Lisa Diamond has shown in a longitudinal study, young women who identify as lesbian at one point may identify as bisexual later, or perhaps none of the above. And it's true that men also may come out as gay later in life, and when they're 30, 40, 50 or later. But if you ask those men, you know, what they were earlier, they'll nearly always say, oh yeah, I knew I was attracted to men, but I just couldn't deal with it, or I wanted to be conventionally married or something like that. So it's really a sort of coming out or admission of something they knew about themselves the whole time. Whereas with quite a few women, you really hear these stories, no, I was heterosexually married, I was very sexually attracted to my husband and other men, and then it sort of emerged without my sort of thinking about it, but I just became aware of being attracted to women later in life. And that's something that really needs to be explained and hasn't been yet. I would say, though, that the fact that a trait appears later in life doesn't necessarily mean that that biology is irrelevant to it, that it has to be a sort of result of life experiences. Of course, people always think it is because they say, oh, you know, I met a certain woman or something like that. But actually, there's plenty of traits. Well, I'm bald, for example. And that I'm bald because of genes that run in my family. That's very clear. But I had a full head of hair, actually, until well into my 20s. So things can happen. You know, traits can emerge later in life that that are really under strong genetic control, but didn't appear later. In fact, cognitive psychologists who study genetic effects on behavioral traits have found that the heritability, that is the genetic influence on traits, actually increases the longer you live. Mm. Apparently because when you're young, when you're a child particularly, family influences and other factors very strongly influence your character, your behavior, your personality and so on. And after you leave home, after you solicit, you then sort of become yourself, if you like. And that is where the genes really sort of show themselves. So don't know what the reason is for this difference between men and women, but it's a very striking one, and it's something hopefully eventually will be understood.
Well, I want to get in actually to your theory about the origins of this, but before we do that, one more definition I think that's really important to get is the distinction between sex and gender. Because I think when we get into a little more of the science, it's important to understand what the difference is.
Well, most scientists use the word sex simply mean male or female.
So they say, like the chromosomes almost.
Yes, what sex are you? That you're either male or female, although it actually isn't quite as clear-cut as that. And if you really look carefully enough, you'll find that quite a few people can't really quite be shoehorned into those two categories. But gender is usually used to mean the psychological attributes, the whole sort of package, if you like, of psychological attributes that go along with being male or female, at least in a statistical way. So a sort of cluster of traits that tend to be shown by men more than women or by women more than men. That's what we think of as gender. And people often think, oh, gender must be sort of a result of the environment, and sex is the result of biology. And what I'm trying to preach is, no, that's not really true. Gender also can be very strongly influenced by factors such as prenatal hormones and genes.
In some ways, a simple way of looking at it is gender is masculine and feminine. It's like in language. It's a male can easily show a feminine aspect or behavior, but be male. So there's a sort of a distinction there.
Right. And, of course, boys like those ones I showed you earlier who are male, teenagers, but have feminine traits, whether actually they're gay or not, well, many of them do become gay, are exposed. It seems to be that which exposes them more than anything to the kind of harassment that has, in these few cases, led to suicides. There seems to be an aversion to femininity in males, in boys or men, that is unbelievably strong in some parts of our society, and it has a very toxic effect. There is something of the reverse thing, too, an aversion to masculinity in women, certainly, but it doesn't seem to be quite as virulent as what one sees
against... What was the term you applied to that, feminophobia?
Femophobia is the word that's sometimes used. I mean, the fear or hatred of femininity in a male. And I think that's in a way almost stronger than homophobia, which is the sort of hatred or fear of homosexuality.
Well, now, to get down to the actual theory here, which, emerged out of your work and a lot of work since, but it's basically that this sexual orientation emerges out of this package of gender qualities that is actually emerging during the development of the embryo in the influenced by levels of hormones. And, there's a lot of evidence for this. And it's probably, I don't know how you would begin, to sort of state this in a clear way.
Well, it starts again with biology. It starts with animals, actually. I mean, there's a whole lot of research now into what causes animals, laboratory animals such as rats, to prefer to mate with other, with males or with females. In fact, I think somewhere I have a, if I can just zip through all this stuff, which is not very relevant to here, sort of a cartoon
there you go.
Of how one might test, as it were, the sexual orientation of a rat. Where you're looking down on a maze, it's a tea maze, a very simple maze. You're looking down from on top of it. You put that rat in the start box. It wanders down to a junction, and it has the choice of turning left and mating with a very receptive female and very hot female rat that's tethered down there. Or it can turn right and mate with an equally hot tethered male rat there. And you see what it does, and before it consummates its desire, you grab it, you take it back to the start box again, and you do it about 100 times, and you get a sort of measure of what's called its Kinsey score, which is its preference to its sexual attraction, as it were, towards males.
It's a very simple test.
Yeah. Now, your standard off-the-shelf, straight out of the carton rat they're pretty heterosexual, most of them. That's to say that a male will gravitate towards females, females towards males. But if you manipulate the hormones to which this rat was exposed while its brain was differentiating, while it was developing, during a certain critical period, then a rat only lasts a very few days, just before and just around the time of birth, you can produce an outcome that's atypical, actually. You can produce a male rat, and not just rats, but also hamsters, pigs, zebra finches, which will preferentially gravitate towards a sex partner of the same sex as itself. And the key hormone here seems to be testosterone. This is the hormone that, during fetal life, drives the development of the brain and the body, actually, in the male direction. If testosterone levels are high, like they are in typically in male fetuses, then the brain tends to develop in a masculine direction. And this affects, we think, not just sexual preference in a task like this, but also a whole constellation of other gendered traits, which in a rat might include things like how it navigates in a maze, the males and females behave differently in that situation. And you can change that by this kind of intervention. So that's the, and you can also show in these animals that their brains have actually developed anatomically in a different way as a result of that intervention. So, you know, there are sex differences in the brain, in the hypothalamus, for example, and many other parts of the brain.
It's like the rest of the body, basically.
Right, yes, exactly. It's a very gendered organ, the brain. You can control, as it were, how that differentiates the brain structure and brain function by playing around with the testosterone levels that that brain is exposed to during this short critical period. So that's the situation in laboratory animals. Now, the question then is this relevant to human development? A lot of people say, no, how could that possibly be? You know, we're not rats. And, well, we're not. But it's worth looking to see whether there's any sort of commonality. And there is increasing evidence that that something similar really is going on. For example, you can, although you can't do these same experiments in humans, obviously you'd be hauled off to jail if you tried anything like that with the human fetus. But in some cases, nature has done that experiment for you. You know, there are these what they call experiments of nature, certain genetic syndromes, where a fetus, say a female fetus, is exposed to more testosterone than she would otherwise have been. There's, for example, there's one called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where the adrenal glands pump out lots of testosterone or similar hormones. And what's been found is that women who'd had CAH when during development, this condition, are very significantly more likely to experience same-sex attraction and engage in same-sex relationships as compared with control women, such as their unaffected sisters, in a way that's reminiscent of the animal experiments. Now, it's not the case that every woman with CAH is sort of fated to be lesbian. Absolutely not. There's a marked shift, if you like, of the Kinsey scale, but there's not a complete sort of flip, if you like. So, you know, there's room for interpretation. You can say, yes, this shows that the animal experiments are relevant to humans, but also you could say, yeah, but it's not, you know, as complete a thing as perhaps a born-again essentialist, you know, like some people think I am, would like to see, you know. So it's kind of halfway. And
there's a great part of all this biology, which is that the mammalian fetus, the early fetus, develops in a female pattern. And unless it's exposed to testosterone in a male embryo, it develops as a female. And so there is another experiment of nature, which you describe in the book, which is absolutely incredible. And it's in males, human males, that have a mutation in their testosterone receptor as they're developing. And
you're talking about androgen sensitivity syndrome. Yeah. Now, I wouldn't. These are chromosomal males. I wouldn't call them males in the regular sense because I mean, this is interesting because, you know, how you define male and female when you really look at the nitty gritty of it, it's hard to pin down. These individuals with what's called androgen insensitivity syndrome, that is, their bodies and brains just can't respond to testosterone, however much their testes secrete this hormone, it's as if it's not there. They're chromosomally male, that is, if you look under the microscope at their chromosomes, it looks like a male, they have a Y chromosome. But their bodies develop more or less as females, not entirely. And their minds, too, are very much female typical, that is, they grow up thinking they're women and having generally the characteristics of women. Most of them are sexually attracted to men and so forth. So here's a case where you know the chromosomal sex really seems to be irrelevant, if you like, to the person's anatomical and mental fate, if you like.
But I mean, in this case, there's no testosterone in a genetically male.
Well, there's testosterone, but
it's not
doing
it. It's not doing anything.
In fact, it's more than they produce more testosterone than most fetuses do because their body's kind of senses their testosterone's not there, so they say, "Oh, crank up the testosterone pump." Yeah, exactly. And
but when they're born, they look female.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
They're raised female.
Yes. They're not completely female. The internal reproductive tracts are not normal. So, So actually, these people have a hard time. Actually, in many ways, it's a tough thing to be. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does show the tremendous importance of this hormone on the mental and physical development.
These are some of the really, striking things. There are a lot of other, right. say, less striking things you talk about in the book, like birth order.
Well, yes, birth
number of
let me
males.
Just while we're on the topic of hormones, actually, yeah. Somewhere here. You see, when I talked about congenital adrenal hyperplasia a moment ago, that was a rather rare syndrome. Now I see half the audience already anxiously examining their fingers. Let me assure you. back a bit. What we're doing, the CAH syndrome is a rare syndrome, which you learn something from, but you could say, well, how is that relevant to the great mass of gay people and straight people who don't have a syndrome like that? Well, the way cognitive psychologists look at this is by saying, well, let's look and see if there's some markers in the body that say something about the testosterone level to which you were exposed when you were a fetus. And one that's aroused a great deal of interest and has provoked many studies is this matter of finger length ratios. The fact that there's a basic sex difference here, which is men typically, their index finger is a little bit shorter than their ring finger here. So the D2, D4 ratio, where's the light? Here we are. So the ratio of these two fingers in males is around here, and in straight men here, and in straight women here, it's a little bit closer to equality, very very near one. In other words, these two fingers are very much almost the same length, and this is thought to reflect exposure to testosterone during fetal life, which tends to produce the male pattern. The group of Mark Breedlove, actually, and Williams at Berkeley some years ago reported that there's a difference between heterosexual women and gay and bisexual women, to the effect that in the gay and bisexual women, this ratio is shifted somewhat, on average, in the male direction. And they used that as to support the idea that even when you look at lesbians, bisexual, and straight women in general, without looking at any particular syndrome, you still see some evidence that there's a developmental difference related to sexual orientation. And this has been extended now to other anatomical traits, such as arm length and various other measurements. Now, this particular study doesn't show any difference between gay and straight men in this parameter. As you can see, they're the same. There's been a bunch of studies since then, all of which confirm the female difference. And one or two have also shown a difference in males. A very large study involving about 500,000 people on the internet from around the world came up with a difference of the kind you might expect, which is to say this ratio in gay men was shifted in the female direction a little bit. But I want to emphasize, these are very statistical things. By looking at your hands, like some of you were earlier on, if what you see does not match your inner sense of what your sexual orientation is, you do not need therapy. what you think about yourself is right. Your hands are just, you know, it's slightly out of kilter or something.
Okay. There are a lot of interesting things like this. The other one is the number of older male siblings.
Oh, yes. This is a interesting, fairly recent thing that's been worked on in the last few years. A Canadian group of researchers from the Clark Institute in Toronto have shown in many studies now, and this only applies to men, actually, not to women, that boys who have an older brother are more likely to develop into gay men than are boys who don't have an older brother. There's some effect of having an older brother which increases your chances of developing into a gay man. And when I first heard that, I thought, okay, that's almost certainly some sort of social effect, because it's something to do with the fact, you know, growing up with an older brother that produces this. Perhaps, for example, parents impose certain expectations on a firstborn son, which kind of force him into a sort of straight path. And whereas later-born sons are allowed a certain amount of freedom to do their own thing and perhaps come out as gay more readily or something like that. And that certainly resonates in my own family. I want to have 5 boys, actually. I have, I'm the second. I'm gay. My older brother, as I've said about 3 times already today, my older brother is gay too. So in our family, it's gay, gay, straight, 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 which is doesn't really mesh with the idea that you know the later born sons with older brothers should be gay. My older brother actually has never been very out about being gay. I mean, he is, but he's never been comfortable. He married heterosexually, had children, and so forth. Whereas I was kind of, you know, pretty gay from the get-go. So I always thought, well, maybe it's that, you know, these people go out and they ask people, and the firstborn gay guys don't fess up to being gay, whereas the later ones do. Well, it turns out that's not the reason, because in detailed studies by the Canadian group, they've shown that it doesn't matter even if you grew up with an older brother or not, as long as you had an older brother. So if you were adopted out of that family at birth, basically, and put into another family where perhaps you were the only boy, you'll still have that increased chances of being gay. So it's something apparently biological about being a later-born son which increases the chance of being gay. And the Canadian researchers think, they speculate, that it's an immunological effect caused by the fact that the mother, during the first pregnancy with a male child, institutes sort of immunological memory of having had a male child in that fetus and generates antibodies, in some cases, against male-specific antigens that is basically become a slightly allergic to maleness, if you like. I mean, that's a kind of crude way of putting it. And that this affects the development of a later-born son in such a way as to guide him, to affect his brain development and guide him somewhat more towards homosexuality. And people have even put forward evolutionary theories about why that should be. That is, the notion that parents do best in an evolutionary sense to produce diversity in their offspring, and that this is one way of producing diversity and reducing competition among siblings, which tends to sort of reduce the benefit of having several offspring. I don't know how good that theory is, but it's one that's been presented. So that's the birth order effect. It's a weak effect, actually. It probably only accounts for, you know, a small amount of the homosexuality that's out there in the population. It's interesting because the numbers of the family size has decreased tremendously over the last 200 years. Back in 1800, the average woman had between 8 and 9 children or pregnancies, so that most men had an older brother, actually. And nowadays, most men don't have a brother at all because the numbers, you know, the average number of children is about 2. So to the extent that that's a factor, you would expect this kind of homosexuality would actually be decreasing over the years because so few men now have older brothers. So you could have... What I'm trying to say is this, that if there's one kind of homosexuality that's actually to do with this older brother effect, and there's another kind of male homosexuality that has some other cause, such as genes, then you could have a change in the sort of characteristics of male homosexuality over 200 years due to the fact that one of these effects is actually sort of dropping out of the population. So biology can actually produce changes as well as sort of a static thing. And I say that to argue against the point of view that you often hear, which say, oh, if there's any difference between now and 200 years ago, or if there's any difference between now here and, you know, Taiwan or something, then it can't be a biological. Well, that's just not true. That's
a good point. So I think before we get to questions, there's one more fascinating aspect to this brain part of it, which you brought up before. There's this, what's called a sexually dimorphic system in the brain that controls sexuality, reproduction, even parental behavior. And the interesting part about this, including what Simon showed in his paper, was that this basic sex circuit is overall, it's the same in males and females. It has the same parts. It's just some parts are larger, some parts are smaller, so the ratios change a little bit in males and females. And this actually has a lot of implications for masculine and sexual, feminine behavior, male, female behavior, because actually the systems for masculine and feminine behavior are in everybody's brain. And it's really, it's the ratio within that circuit that changes. And you can certainly show this in animals with lesions.
Yes. And in fact, now, there was just yesterday, actually, it was published a study in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in which researchers studied the brains of teenagers, basically, from the age of about 9 to 22, imaging it with brain scanning technology. And they studied about 600 children, 300 boys, 300 girls. And then they created movies where they look at the changes in brain structure over the teenage years. And they have a movie where they show the differences between the male and the female brain over this period. And you can see these differences emerging, how the parts of the brain that are responsible for traits where girls tend to be very good at, such as certain language tasks, so to blossom in girls and sort of wither away slightly in boys. And conversely, parts that are involved in tasks that males tend to be good at, like certain spatial tasks, tend to do the reverse thing. And you can see in this video how these waves of sexual differentiation sort of move across the brain. It's very striking. And striking to me that you can now study stuff in the brains of living, developing human beings that, you know, 10 or 15 years ago you could only study in rats.
No, it's phenomenal.
Or dead humans.
Yeah, that's right.
Like I did.
That is a great way. I'm sure there are going to be a lot of questions, so let's leave plenty of time here. And we've got time. We'll get in. Oh, yes. Simon, thank you. But we've got a good 20 minutes here, so we can really have some good in-depth conversations here. If you can use the microphone, we'll take the question down here in front first. We'll try and get to everybody. Yes.
Thank you for a fascinating discussion. I should preface this by saying I'm the fourth of four brothers. Mm-hmm. I'm a straight male. But I wonder if your studies have shed any light on the fact that it seems to me straight men are certainly eager to see gay women.
They're what, sorry?
Eager to see gay women. But I'm not so sure that the straight women are eager to see gay men. Is there something about the physiological or psychological attraction of seeing gays of the opposite sex for men that don't equate with women?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, actually. There's a whole, supposedly a whole market in gay male pornography that's aimed at heterosexual women. So apparently quite a few straight women really enjoy the male body, you know, in that context. So I'm not sure. I don't know. Other people may have comments on that. It's not something that struck me as a consistent difference. There is a difference in terms of, there's this imbalance in terms of homophobia, which is direct. First of all, homophobia becomes much more from men than from women. Men tend to be much more anti-gay in their attitudes than women are. But also, it tends to be directed more against gay men than against lesbians. I mean, it's certainly not true that lesbians are immune to discrimination or gay bashing or anything, but there is, on balance, a difference. And the way I see it is that this happens because basically straight men like the concept of lesbian sex. I mean, they think it's basically women having sex with women. Well, having sex with women is great, you know. There's nothing. They like it, you know. Whereas when they think about gay sex, it's having sex with men. You know, yuck. You know, that's sort of rather aversive to a lot of straight men. And so I think that may be part of the reason why homophobic attitudes and behaviors by some straight men tends to be much more directed against gay men than against lesbians.
I think there's a question here. Yeah.
Could you perhaps expand a little bit more on the effect of chemicals, both endogenous and exogenous? I'm thinking of straight male is strongly attracted to female A, but not to B or C, and that's often attributed to chemical signals that are sent that may reset part of the brain. We are seeing that young women are reaching puberty much earlier, possibly from chemicals in the environment.
Right, right.
Frogs in certain contaminated waters, their testes now show ovarian features. So
right.
The chemical change.
This is a very contentious area. Part of what you're talking about is the area of pheromones. And the idea that bodily secretions can actually influence sexual attraction from one person to another. And in fact, just for kind of fun, I'll quickly show one slide that illustrates that. This is a Swedish study where bodily secretions from the armpits of men, probably not from this particular gentleman, but you know what's wrong with showing a picture of Arnold in his prime? And the purified in this substance, androstenedione, is extracted from the secretions and then presented to the noses of these unfortunate volunteers who are placed inside a positron emission tomographic scanner. And then you look at the images of the brains that are generated. And what's been reported in this Swedish study is that there are differences in the responses of gay men, straight men, lesbians, heterosexual women to odors derived from men and women in a way that kind of reinforces my studies of anatomical differences in the hypothalamus. There are also functional differences illustrated by this kind of study.
I mean, this happens to be in exactly the same region that your study was
yes,
involved in.
Yes, this region here, which is lit up here in the gay men, is the front part of the hypothalamus, which includes the area that I studied, although it's much bigger than that area. It's certainly a part of the brain that we know is involved in the regulation of sexual behavior. Now, the other part of your study, your question, was about environmental pollutants. And those certainly do play a role in terms of animals. I mean, we know that frogs are having their sex changed by some of these hormone-like drugs in the environment. The extent to which this is happening in humans is still a matter of considerable debate, and we don't really know, but it's something that needs to be studied because it's potentially a major problem.
I've forgotten the details, but was there a time when pregnant women were treated with steroid hormones
that
might have had an effect on...
Yes, there's the hormone called diethylstilbestrone, or DES, which was given to pregnant women to prevent miscarriages, which itself was a miscarriage of justice, if you like, because it was. It turns out this drug does not even have that effect, but in fact, it had much worse effects, which was to cause cancer in some of the female offspring of these pregnancies. That was one example of a pharmaceutical drug which was had rather dire effects on development. So it's something that needs to be researched.
This lady in the front row first.
I think it used to be part of the literature of whatever that women or mothers caused homosexuality
right.
in their sons. But now I'm wondering, when I'm listening to you, are you saying that the diet of mothers or the chemistry of mothers when they were carrying the children may have been a cause of sexual development or gender development in their fetuses?
No, not really. There's no evidence that diet, for example, during pregnancy would have an effect of that kind. I mean, if you swallowed tons of hormone pills or something, but people don't do that, and that's not a factor. I think... mostly the evidence points towards genetic differences playing a role, and also sort of random variations in hormone levels that occur actually as a result of nothing. You know, the human development is not something that's rigidly specified by genes. We only have 20,000 genes, and we have millions, billions of cells in our brains. So there's a lot of sort of randomness there. And I believe some of this randomness
works through this hormonal channel to produce variations in gender traits.
There's a very
There's
a very interesting thing in animals like rats, where they have six or eight pups lined up in a row, and if there's a female embryo between two males, the female in the middle is masculinized because of the testosterone coming from the two other embryos.
But no, I mean, I don't think at this point that parents really, you know, have much responsibility. It's funny, I quite often talk to PFLAG meetings, you know, which is the Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and they kind of love me because they think of me as the person who's sort of taken the weight of blame off their shoulders for making their kids gay. And what I always say to them is, well, you know, in 10 years' time, you'll be going a completely different tack. You know, homosexuality would be so popular at that point. You'll be saying stuff like, oh, yeah, I read, you know, a chapter from Great Gays in History every day to my baby, and you know, this is how we got into be gay and so forth. You know what I mean?
But what you're saying is there's no hard evidence, actually, that there's any real influence there.
Of parents' behavior or diet or things like that. Now, I won't say we've proven that there are no effects like that. There might be, but I think if there are, they're going to be pretty minor effects.
Tony?
Thank you. Dr. LeVay, because you began this colloquy on the subject of the 15-year-old and 13-year-olds who committed suicide this week, I'd like to just tweak this, if we can for a second, in the direction of the social situation as opposed to the science. And although you may have insight into how each affects each other. But my question to you is, it seems to me, my theory is that because bashing has become a federal offense just recently, thanks to the Obama administration, and hate crimes are now illegal, that there is a different type of bashing that is taking place, which is not a physical bashing, but a harassment that's causing kids to feel... Because I know as a gay man, at 13 years old, I felt like the world was collapsing when I realized I had these impulses and that I was never going to be able to survive in society. And I lived through bashings because of the time that I was growing up. But today, it's frowned upon. So I'm just curious, from a social point of view, if you think that the both the legal aspect of it and the social taboo of actually beating people up has caused a different type of bullying and a hope among the aggressors that people take their own lives.
Well, I don't know about different type of bullying. It may be because, of course, a lot of kids are coming out as gay much younger than they did before. So they're exposing themselves to bullying that perhaps their earlier generation would not have done. A lot of bullying is not really directed... a lot of bullying that gay kids encounter is not really directed against the fact they're gay as much as the fact they're showing gender nonconformist traits. A lot of these kids don't even know they're gay yet. You know, they're what we call pre-gay, you know, or they may never become gay. And it's this sort of gender violation that seems to be extremely sort of caustic in terms of provoking these gay bashings and so forth. I think that the science has some potential for helping the situation. I think that it by demonstrating evidence that homosexuality is more than simply, you know, I think I'll try that gay thing with this weekend, that it really is something rather deep in people's nature. It in a sense, kind of elevates gay people to a status deserving of protection, such as, for example, racial classifications enjoy. And this is something that has been discussed in some detail in many court cases where scientists have testified, such as myself, about what is homosexuality, how does it come about. So it's relevant. Whether it should be relevant, I don't know. I mean, in many ways, I say, why should we worry about what causes people to be gay? Why can't we just get on with life and accept people the way they are? But in some contexts, it is important, and it does seem to have some influence.
Well, particularly in education with children.
Right.
Okay, a question back here. Hey, just one sec.
I was wondering about the the birth order issue. So we should be able to see at one point in time now major cross-cultural differences, right? I mean, so if you have cultures like China with their one-child policy, and you have cultures where it's typical to have 5 to 10 children, there should, across those populations, be differences.
You might predict that. This is only relates to the birth order effect, which itself is not a very strong effect. So it's not that the totality of male homosexuality is due to this effect, but part of it is, a modest part. But yes, you might see some cross-cultural effects. For example, several studies have reported that male homosexuality is slightly more common in Hispanic communities than it is among non-Hispanic communities. And Hispanics also tend to have larger family size. So it immediately comes to my mind, is that those two facts connected through the birth order effect? We don't know. Now, you mentioned China. Of course, yeah, you're right about what you say. The ironic thing, of course, is that the sex ratio in China is now strongly skewed towards males. So the Chinese government, if they were smart, were trying to figure out a way to produce more gay men so that because otherwise there's going to be this crisis. In fact, there's already starting to be this crisis of not enough sex partners for men in China. So that would be my advice. Do some research on on increasing the prevalence of homosexuality.
A gentleman right here. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned today on the radio that there was a difference between homosexuality, heterosexuality, and bisexuality. What is the difference in between bisexuality and homosexuality and heterosexuality?
Well, yeah, it's a difficult issue, I have to say. First of all, scientists tend to be rather simple-minded people and go for the real simple subdivisions of humanity for as long as they can until they're forced into something more complicated. And so many, many studies have simply said, you know, are you gay or are you straight, and just left it at that. So bisexuality has to some extent been sort of elided from scientific discourse, and that's something that needs to be corrected. Now, to the studies that have looked at bisexuality, there's this major difference between the sexes, such that male bisexuality is rather uncommon, particularly at the level of sexual arousal. If you actually, you know, do the rather gross experiment of putting, you know, a little sensor around a man's penis while showing him erotic images of males and females, you find that men fall into these two groups. And even if you recruit specifically men who identify as bisexual, they usually show arousal, penile arousal, to only images of one sex and not the other. It's usually to images of men. In other words, bisexually identified men seem to fall in with gay men in that respect, most of them. But not all of them, but the majority. With women, it's very different. When you do these sorts of genital studies, genital arousal, you actually can persuade yourself that all women are bisexual, because there's... you can't really tell, you can't really, as it were, diagnose a woman's sexual orientation by showing her erotic images of say, naked men and naked women, and seeing how her genitals respond to those images. It seems like women will respond regardless of which image is shown and what their sexual orientation is. So there's clearly a difference in that respect. And but again, most of the studies that have looked at bisexually identified women have, in these sorts of cognitive and anatomical studies, like the finger length studies, the bisexual women go with the out-and-out lesbians. So it's almost as if there's heterosexual women and then non-heterosexual women as two sort of major divisions of sexual orientation in women.
Yes, the gentleman here in the green.
Green?
Green. Gray.
I'll be green, that's fine. First, when dealing with things like handedness or dwarfism, things outside the norm, there seem to be multiple etiologies. There's, sometimes you have results that you're looking at, but there could be more than one possible cause. Right. I'm wondering if the research is even starting to look at the idea that you may have different classes of people that you're classifying as homosexual with different etiologies. And just a second quick thing. when you're talking about the androgen resistance, I heard about cases in the Dominican Republic and in the Dominican community of people born XY, and then at puberty, the hormone hits and a penis descends, and they go from being pouched to having a penis, and then seem to be functioning. I wonder if you've looked at studies about these communities.
Yes, these are famous set of studies by Julianne Imperator McGinley over many years, and it's been replicated in other countries now. And yes, these kids do seem to change sex at puberty from girls to becoming men. What's striking about these studies is that most of these men, that is, these individuals who become men at puberty, they are sexually attracted to women. In other words, probably as a result of the fact that their brains were exposed to testosterone prenatally. In other words, this seems, even though these children were brought up as girls completely, the fact that their brains were exposed to testosterone prenatally seems enough to generate heterosexual attraction to women when they're adults. So it seems to go along with the same basic idea, if you like. What was the previous, the question was... Yeah, I think that, you know, I was kind of alluding to that before. For example, that this birth order effect, men who are gay as a result of the birth order effect may be actually qualitatively different from gay men who are say genetically gay. This association with femininity, for example, doesn't seem to be very strong in gay men who have older brothers. It's much stronger in gay men who don't have older brothers. So there could be different kinds of male homosexuality that have different developmental pathways, and the same may well be true for women too. I mean, we know there are, you know, for example, there's a butch femme distinction that's had varying levels of acceptance in the lesbian community over the years, and that might have it also reflect some different developmental trajectory, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here in.
Hello, Professor. I have more than a passing interest in anthropology and evolutionary psychology. And my understanding is that genetically, human beings have a dynamic, I guess, based on the four Fs, like fight or flight, feeding, and finding a way to make love.
Okay.
And my understanding is that the sex is developed in order to simply reproduce, to keep the species going. Based on what you're saying here, I'm getting a kind of an understanding. I've always felt that maybe homosexuality was kind of a naturally occurring mutation in the human genome. So my question is very simply... what is the, is it, or is there a biological reason for homosexuality?
Right. That's a very interesting question, which one could write a whole chapter on, which I did, in fact. it's hard for me to summarize it more, you know, aptly than simply say, you know, read the book. But the there are a whole set of theories which try and account for the fact that you might have genes. Predisposing to homosexuality, even though those men who are gay on account of these genes would presumably have less offspring than if they had been heterosexual. So there's a kind of paradox, evolutionary paradox. And most of the theories that have been put forward propose that that these genes, although they may decrease the reproductive success, as it's called, of the men who are actually gay, nevertheless increase the reproductive success of the relatives of these gay men, either the same sex relatives or the opposite sex relatives. One idea, for example, is that the same a gene predisposing to male homosexuality might actually cause the sisters of those gay men who have the same gene to be, as it were, hyper-heterosexual. It would make them even more attracted to men than they otherwise would be, and therefore to have more sex with men and have more children. And there's some evidence actually to support that. There's some studies saying that the sisters and other female relatives of gay men actually have more children than the female relatives of straight men.
There was one fabulous theory you brought up that I hadn't heard before that I thought was really clever, and that was going from essentially the hunters to the agrarian society to the Industrial Revolution, where when you go to an agrarian farming society, actually you're not really selecting for aggressiveness necessarily. And so actually as civilization has progressed, there's been a shift towards somewhat more feminine attributes in the population.
People speculate on that. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really know without going back and sort of taking blood samples from, you know, 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. But there is certainly a lot of people speculate that there has been a genetic drift in the human species over the 10,000 years since the agrarian revolution, which involves some sort of feminization, particularly in males. And that this feminization might actually also, as a sort of byproduct, increase the likelihood of homosexuality. It's an idea. It's a kind of neat idea in some ways, but it's going to be hard to find actual evidence to support or disprove it.
I think we have time for two more questions, and we have them over here. Yes.
In considering the birth order effect, let's use the example of three brothers who are born close in age. Would the third brother be more likely to be homosexual if the birth order was very close in age?
The studies on homosexuality in this respect have not addressed that question, but there are effects on birth weight, actually. That is, later-born boys are also lighter than earlier-born boys. And that effect is clearly related not just to the fact that boys were born before, but that those earlier pregnancies were close in time to the individual you're talking about. So there is, apparently in that respect, an effect of exactly what you're talking about. It hasn't been looked at with regard to being gay or not.
Okay, one final question.
First, thank you both for a fascinating talk. My question is sort of relevant to what you had just discussed a minute ago, and that is that over time in the past, homosexuality was not always demonized, like in the Greek culture and Roman cultures. I would like your thoughts on why you think current, you know, even in China today, I hear about gay bashing all the time, even though you say there's not that many with those single parents. But, you know, in this culture, it just seems so much demonization of the process. And why do you think that is?
It's true, and certainly, you know, for example, if you read the writings of Walter Williams, anthropologist at USC, who's written studied Native American cultures, you see in some of those cultures a sort of an acceptance of gender variance and homosexuality that is really striking. You know, to someone, a Westerner reading that material, it's almost unbelievable that these people could be so honored in society. Yeah, there is something. Yes. So what's going on in our own culture? I mean, you know, there's a sort of temptation, obviously, to blame religion and Christianity because there's suddenly a very sex negative tradition in particularly in the early Christian church, to the sense that that sex is fundamentally an unvirtuous trait behavior, and I think that's colored a lot of attitudes. But whether that's really a cause or whether in some sense that's really a consequence of Western civilization, I really don't know. I think that's something that'd be wonderful to understand better.
Well, I think it's time to bring this to a close. And I'd like, first of all, to thank the Library Association for having us. And I hope everyone continues to support them. And of course, Simon, thank you so much for your talk.
Thank you, Larry, very much.
Loud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.